Hi everyone, and welcome to the second episode of the Cancer Researcher podcast from the European Association for Cancer Research. How does a student become the master? I am your host, Dr. Alexandra Boitor, scientific officer at the EACR and a former early career researcher myself. I can well remember from my PhD and postdoc days how overwhelming it can feel at times to be surrounded by senior scientists and preeminent figures in your research field. And in those moments, one cannot help but wonder, how does the student become the master? Today, I have with me Dr. Sara Zanivan, professor at the University of Glasgow and senior research investigator at Cancer Research UK Beetson Institute, Dr. Christian Frezza, the Alexander von Humboldt professor of metabolomics in aging at the Cologne Cluster of Excellence of Cellular Stress Response in Aging-Associated Disease, short CCAD, at the University of Cologne in Germany, and Dr. Arkaitz Karasidio, Iker Basque Research Professor at Proteomics Unit and Group Leader at the Center for Cooperative Research in Biosciences in Spain, who will share with us some career advice based on their experience of joining the world of independent researchers. They openly address some of the challenges you might encounter in this process and discuss their current approach to supporting the development of early career researchers. Hello everyone, and thank you so much for joining me this evening. Can you please tell us a little bit about your current team? In a nutshell, what is your team leader approach all about? Sara, would you like to go first?
Yeah, sure. At the moment, I have two positions in my lab, and it's a very interdisciplinary lab because I have a research group, but I'm also head of an advanced technology proteomic facility, which means that I have biologists, a clinical fellow, a bioinformatician, and mass spectrometry proteomics experts. And I think they are working very well altogether. So there is the technical group that is developing technology for my own research, but also for the entire institute. And then there is my group. So this has probably been a bit challenging at the beginning. The way I do it in terms of time, I try to split how often I interact with the different teams. And the other important thing for me is always to have some one-to-one time to be able to really have a discussion with everybody in the group. So I think for me it's very important because I can really understand each person and then try to lead them in the most appropriate way.
I think that, as I said, it's very important to personalize management, and we are scientists are not managers by default. So perhaps one of the aspects is that we lack all the training on human resources and leadership. I think that this is a limitation that we need to cover through different means. So one important aspect that we try to implement in the lab and in the institute is that people is trained on leadership from the get-go, as PhD students, as postdocs, so they understand what are the basics of the process, and this helps mentor-mentee relationships. So I think there is a whole aspect on how we teach to lead or how we learn to lead that makes a difference on the science that we do.
So would you say that you managed to develop leadership skills beginning from your PhD and your postdoc, or is that something that you learn on your own later on?
Yeah, I did not, but I think that we should. So I think that more and more, it should accompany the whole training process. We shouldn't be trained as experimentalists and then all of a sudden one day become group leaders and manage people, but rather understand what are the guidelines to leadership, to healthy supervision, to communication. In the lab, we have some dedicated meetings to mentorship, to meet with people that is supervising other people, so that we discussed about the problems, the limitations, the opportunities, the process, the experience, and this helps us all finding new strategies to make a healthy environment and making better trainees.
Maybe just to follow on what Arka said, I think it's very often assumed that when you move from your postdoc to your independent career, that somehow you will figure out how to lead your lab. Nobody at least told me that you will need to lead a team and you need to know. But I think it's absolutely vital to to make sure that we receive training about that, because managing people is probably the most unexpected, if you wish, but also the toughest part of the job of a scientist when deep into that. I think they're doing something remarkable, but I think it should be done, you know, by universities or something. Because anyway, the leadership skill, you will need them at every career. If you are a PhD, you need to develop some leadership when you need to either manage or talk to others. It's not only, you know, when you have your own independent.
Correct me if I got the wrong idea, but Arka, were you suggesting that mentorship schemes could help in this process of developing leadership skills?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's instrumental that not only we get a guideline, as Christian said, this shouldn't be try and error, because for a person that is not trained, those errors might dictate the future of their career or their labs. For example, one of the first things that I emphasize when someone comes to me discussing about starting a lab is you need to give it a thought and think about what are the values that you want to establish in the lab. And by values is not which experiments or research lines, is what do you want people to think about when they join? What do you want people to preserve when they join? What is your strategy? And this is a training process. When they come as experimentalists, you mentor them and you start the leadership process with them to do a given project.
And you mentioned that you believe that everyone should have some core values, not necessarily research related. Would you be willing to share with us what are the core values in your lab?
I mean, yes, to me, the core values is that first has to be the question. So research has to be driven by the question, and people need to think that if the question is relevant, this is a matter of team effort. So we are a small society in a lab. The larger the lab is, the more complex it becomes. So we need to think that we are here to answer research questions. And for that, we need two components, creativity and motivation. And this is not only scientific. This is something that is nurtured through the environment of the lab. So respect, collegialism, help, and sometimes leaving your priorities aside to help the person beside you is what makes a lab work.
Is there anything that you as a supervisor can do to help someone feel more motivated when your students or your postdocs, for instance, have a low moment?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to acknowledge that we have no moment. I think one of the first steps is to acknowledge the lack of motivation due to specific problems. I think this is something often, I mean, people don't think about it. They simply go on and then they procrastinate to face the issue. And this brings me to the value that we also share in the lab, that is the concept of psychological safety. This is basically the ability and the possibility of each of the lab members to speak out when they have a problem, whatever, scientific or not. And this is one of the values that we share as a team, is the ability to speak out. So when we have a problem, first talk about it. Then it's impossible to have someone that is constantly motivated. I speak from direct experience. So it's only when you have a very clear goal and the long-term goals. It's not something, you know, a project that you achieve, that you were prepared to publish. That's not the long-term motivation that you seek. You need to see something that is without direct, you know, achievement, like publishing the paper, but something long-term, like knowledge. If you keep this, the knowledge, the passion that you have for a specific topic, if you keep that in mind, even if you heard hurdles along the line, you will be able to go over this. It's normal that you will find this. It's normal, especially a PhD student. There is always a second year crisis most of the time, and you will go through this. It's inevitable. So as long as we know that there is a process and you have a clear vision at the end, I think that's a really good strategy to keep people motivated. I don't know if it works, but at least it's a way.
I would argue that the vision of many researchers, early career researchers, include to become a team leader someday, or an independent researcher. And I was wondering, how did you know you were ready to make that step?
I don't think you never know when you're ready until you are. And so, of course, there are technical issues, meaning papers, meaning CV, okay? And this is one aspect. Then there is the leadership part and the component of the job that we just discussed. These are things that actually could be separated. So we can discuss for hours when it's time to go, when you postdoc, and you published very well, maybe one or two very good papers, then you know that you can apply, for instance, for independent funding. So this is the technical part of the job. So yes, I can be ready. Then you need to want this, okay? You need to want to be independent. And that's the other aspect that very often is assumed, that if you are a good scientist and publish well, you want to be a PI and take all these other things that are not directly scientific. So that is the other question. And for that, you never know what is going to happen until you do it. Because the job that you're going to embark is completely different from what you were doing as a postdoc, I think. So you have some signs that you might have in leadership, but until you try, you never know. At least this was my experience.
I knew that I wanted to become independent, so that was clear. But I remember that I didn't feel ready yet. But then there was this opportunity for a group leader position that really ticked all the boxes. So it was to do technology development, working in cancer research, and didn't want to miss the opportunity. But here I would like to say another thing, that at that time I really wanted to apply, but then I felt I'm not sure I'm ready. And then one day a postdoc in the lab told me, I think that's the position for you. And at that point I got the courage, right, to apply. So you don't feel probably ready, but I also think what is important is probably to have a people around you that can support you when you want to make that step.
I think that in our career, the more I share the experience with other people, the more prevalent I think it is the imposter syndrome. So I was completely convinced that I would fail miserably when I was offered that position. So I took it because there was the opportunity. I took it because I thought that I had to. But the moment I committed and I knew that in a year time I would become a PI, everything that happened to me was to me interpreted as, you see, you're not ready. And the fact is that I started the lab and everything that would happen, shipment didn't go through, the samples were lost. This is a signal. This is a signal that you will fail. And I think that we need this kind of support saying, this is not easy. It's not a job for everyone. So being a PI is a completely different job from being a scientist at the bench. And I have people in the lab and we often discuss about career path, meaning what do you want to do? Because maybe not all doors are open, but it's very important that you want to address which doors to knock. And then we can build a strategy to get you there. So either you become a PI, you go to industry, you teach, you abandon, but then what happens when with all the people that is highly trained, that is very good experimentalist, that leads people, that keeps the core values, but don't want to be a PI? The thing is, if we don't generate stable positions for them, so there's a problem with science in lack of stability, and this goes with conciliation, with family, with career breaks, with this risk of missing the train. If I don't keep up, I will miss the train.
So you're actually saying something that I know for sure it was on my mind when I was a postdoc, and I'm sure it's on the mind of many other young career researchers. How do you balance your personal life, be it family, hobbies, or anything else, with your work life without fearing that it would impede your career progression?
Yeah, I think there's no easy answer. To me, it's a limit that you must put, because our job, it's directly proportional to the hours that we invest. To some extent, you do 10 experiments more, you get more data, more success. If we don't favor that, there has to be limits, that we cannot have this idea that I'm competing with everybody, so I need to go faster, but rather that I'm going to be more robust. I think Christine alluded to it. Psychological safety is saying, okay, you do the best you can, and then do other things. Go home, have balance. We need some safety, and for that, we need to push that there are working hours. Our work is flexible, and this flexible doesn't mean that you need to work more. It means that sometimes you need to push, and sometimes you can pull, and you can have the benefits of our flexibility, of our job, of traveling, of...
You mentioned the flexibility is often seen as a perk of our job, but actually I think it can backfire tremendously, because be flexible doesn't mean that you can work as little as you want, but that you can work, you know, as many hours as you want. And it's never nice. It's always more than what you can actually do. I think you need to be very firm in establishing the boundaries. My example, before my PhD, I worked in a company, so we had very strict hours. I started my PhD with that mentality, due also to the fact that I had to commute. So I had very fixed schedule every day, starting in 8, finishing at, I don't know, 5 or 6 with the train, and I maintained that. And I suggest to do this to everyone in the lab, because it gives you time to do things at home after 5 or 6 whenever. And I bet you this is the problem. If you organize yourself well, you can do this and you can be efficient and successful. The problem is very often, due to the fact that you think the job is flexible, you instill a lot of inefficiency in your job. So you can say, since I can work later, I will do later. And so you erode all your time after job and you don't have any more boundaries between your life and the job. But I encourage people to have very clear rules.
I would say that 30% of the people in my lab has kids. And this implies that there are times that we have to go. We really need that boundary and say, okay, this is enough. I need to close and I need to disconnect. And there's people in the lab that say, I need to come later, I need to leave earlier. I need to... What I mean by flexibility is you use your time. You are the owner of your time and you are also responsible of your work. Life has to be. Cannot adapt to our job, but I think this job can give us opportunities to live experiences that, for example, when people go abroad for a postdoc, don't think only about which lab will you go to, which is the city that you want to live in for a period of time. So make it personal so that it's always worth it. If things are more difficult, you have this balance that I'm here and living this unique experience. And when things go well, you are boosted and your motivation goes through the roof. And this helps your work too.
So one thing that I can add is that what made the difference to me is that I started thinking what I would consider a successful life for myself. And at that point, I started separating what I find successful for my job and what I think is successful for my life. And then I tried to find also common values in my job and in my life. And I think that was extremely helpful to start dedicating time for myself. So probably I can open a bracket that I don't have kids, you know. So I was, of course, more into the more I work, the better it is. So I know that, for example, connections are important to me. So I had a lot of connections in the workplace, colleagues, etc. But then I started really working also to have connections outside that were meaningful to me. And that for me was something very helpful.
We often talk about how important it is to have connections and collaborations in academia, but we tend to forget how important it is to have them in our private lives as well. And that brings me to one of the questions that I wanted to ask all three of you, because I've noticed there are some differences in your careers in terms of where you decided to start your own labs. What do you think is the most important thing when you decide where to start your own lab?
I mean, in my case, I think that you need to make it personal. There is people that by living abroad, they see an opportunity. In my case, I went to the States with my wife and we had the clear idea that going back was the priority, that we would have a better balance if we were close to home. So what I try to convey to the people in that, first, one decision at a time. So you are deciding where to go for a postdoc. Don't decide if you're going to come back afterwards. Decide when you're there, because otherwise any decision becomes unbearable. And I always put the same example. So when I went to the States, I furnished my home in one day, in 2 hours. When I came back to Bilbao, it took me 1 year to buy a sofa, because it would be the permanent decision. And this happens with deciding for a postdoc or going for a comment or starting a lab. You think that that decision is irreversible, and irreversibility kills motivation, kills creativity, and limits the decision making. So we need to do one decision at a time, and also be aware that maybe it's not the best decision afterwards, and we can go back. We need to commit, but we need to be aware that perhaps this is not the best for us. So when I started the lab, my wife told me, try it. If it doesn't work, do something else. Think, what other thing would you like to do if this doesn't work? so that you relieve some pressure, saying, so have something else that you think you could also do if this doesn't work, but commit to doing it well.
So I think it's a very personal decision. So in my team, I always respect the decision of the person. From a personal point of view, for me, it was not very important where to go in terms of location, but it was more important the institute where I wanted to go. And for me, it was more important to know that it was a collaborative environment that I could feel well working.
How about you, Christian? If I remember correctly, you've moved your lab fairly recently, haven't you?
Yes, a year ago. So I agree with Sarah. When you move, I think the most important aspect, work-wise, again, we need to separate the work decision. For me, I was based mostly on the people. And when I started the lab in Cambridge, it was about the director, the person who recruited me, and the few PIs that were there. Then now it became even a bigger decision, and it's about, you know, the entire faculty and the place, what I call the microenvironment. So again, it's all about the people. But personally, I discourage people to go to a place just because X lab is successful. I don't think that works. Because if you're not into, in my work, you know, if you don't feel part of the community or the lab, your time can be very difficult unless, you know, you don't care. And it's possible. But I always say, you know, meet the people. You need to think that you will live with these people for a few years. And, you know, there's the personal thing about going back home, like I did, or staying abroad. But I think for me, once I moved from Italy, it was almost like irreversible.
Perhaps the common aspect is the introspection. What are your priorities, personal, professional, work environment, working dynamics? And then take the decision, because I think that sometimes we don't do this introspection very often. So we go with the flow.
I think like the take home message from our conversation today would be, it's this sort of decision of starting or continuing your career, starting your own lab, is very personal. And although I think we tend to forget that we can change things and tend to do things based on what we've seen others do, it's important to think about what you want and not only about where you want to be 10 years from now. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
I just wanted to say something about this, because, you know, it's an example of this question that incessantly appears when you are, when I was a postdoc, everybody was asking, so do you want to be a PI? So this is the question I think that probably all of us got at some point. And I think it puts this kind of pressure that Anka was mentioning, that it seems like, you know, our career has a clear direction, only one, that is this apex of becoming a PI. And everybody, especially because they don't know, started even at the PhD level, when I was a Cambridge PhD, already told me, I want to be a PI, without knowing what it means. So I think this is an error. And it can put you in big trouble, because if you commit to do something that you don't have a clear idea of what it is, you might restrict a lot of other options. And so you might embark in something where you need to be, you know, leader of people and you don't have the skills. And so you will find yourself in a position that you don't find comfortable later on. I think that's something I want for everyone to be clear. So make the decision. Of course, if you start a career in science, do what is best at that stage and think not too soon about what you want to do in 10 years.
I would like to make 2 points. And one is that it's very important that, I don't know if we do it enough, to talk about expectations. So to devote some time with each person in their own career path to talk about expectations. Sometimes instead of, do you want a PI, what do you want to do? You're not closing the question.
Yes.
And doing this every step of the way. So the first thing is talk about expectations, mine as a PI, yours as a person in my lab. And we do this at least once a year, not science-oriented, but training-oriented, and at the level of personal work in the lab, what keeps you motivated, what things can improve as a group leader or the lab dynamics. So the second thing is that making it personal or making your own decision doesn't mean that you're alone. So I think that us as group leaders, as long as we have a voice, we need to change the system. So we need to make the system more robust. So training at every level, alternative career paths, generate positions that are stable, that are compatible with personal life, with family, and still remaining in science without being a PI. So we need to push the institutes to generate the positions, to generate the training, to make researchers that own better their own decisions, because they are better informed, they see the options, and the options exist. We need to show that this is essential for the structure of the scientific system. So we have our part of responsibility to do, to push the system to adapt to needs, and then so that people make informed decisions about what they want to do, one at a time, as Christian said, not 10 years from now. That is the classical question, what do you want to do 10 years from now? No.
Yeah, absolutely.
What is your next step? Take it, and then go to the next one. Don't jump stairs, because you probably fall.
Thank you very much for your answers. This is a very interesting conversation, and I feel like it could go on forever. But I know you are all very busy, so I'm not going to keep you here with me for much longer. I have only one more question to close up, and that would be, reflecting on everything you have achieved in your career so far, what advice would you give to your younger self, if any?
So I thought a lot about that, and I think that I would have looked more proactively to have good mentors and good promoters. So I think that's what I would have looked earlier on, to be more supported in my decision, more helped, I think, in evaluating opportunities and, you know, progressing where I actually wanted to go. More effectively.
Yeah, I would say that I still see my inner self as my younger self. I still feel the same weaknesses and fears as then when I was a PhD student. Perhaps I would tell my younger self if things are going to happen. So there are going to be valleys that are going to be tough. Try to keep a balance and know that they will happen. They will be resolved sometimes by your contribution or others, and they will happen again. So be prepared and feel it as part of the process and not as a personal failure. And the sense of failure that happens when you join a lab and you don't know anything, when then you learn everything, you go to a postdoc and you don't know anything again, and you don't know where things are, you feel like you have no value. You start a lab and you don't know anything again. So I think that making it normal, don't abandon because this happens to everyone, and making it visible and supporting mental health is something that we need to push and really nurture, because it's essential to keep motivation and creativity.
Difficult question. So I think the thing I will say to myself is try to have less control over things, because things will happen, things will pass. Whereas, you know, I'm still paranoid about whenever you see an email or something, you feel the pressure, the urge to act immediately. And, you know, that gives me, for instance, personally, a huge amount of pressure, all these deadlines that arrive. And that makes the present awful. Whereas if you start thinking that, okay, you know, this again will arrive, it will go, and you will make it somehow. If you don't make it, that's fine. So that's what I would say to myself.
Thank you very much for your answers and for agreeing to take part in our podcast.
Thank you very much.
We really hope that you enjoyed listening to Sarah's, Christian's and Arkaid's career advice inspired from their own experiences, finding themselves both on the mentee and on the mentor side of the process. I would like to thank my guests again for being here today with me, and thank you for listening. Look out for our next episode on the 3rd of May, where we'll continue the conversation about career progression in academia with Professor Elaine Mardis and Professor Carlos Caldas. In the meantime, please give us feedback or offer suggestions for other topics or preferred guests by visiting our website at www.eacr.org/podcast. That's www.eacr.org/podcast. Also, on our website at eacr.org, you can find lots of useful information for cancer researchers, such as job opportunities, conferences, free webinars, and our Find a Collaboration tool to help you find collaborators for your own research. We're on Twitter at EACR News, Instagram at Hello EACR, and you can search for us on Facebook and LinkedIn. Thank you for listening, and please join us on the 3rd of May for another episode of the Cancer Researcher podcast. Until then, take care and good luck with your experiments.